Well, hello there, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power, and we shine light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. Purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together. That is, to address problems instead of defending positions. Well, on this week's show, we're going to take a journey. We're going to take a journey to a parallel universe, a reality just as real as this one, maybe even more real. And in this reality, people believe that wearing masks doesn't make most people safer during the COVID crisis. It's a reality where thousands, tens of thousands of Europeans have taken to the streets to protest lockdown, where a huge crowd listened to Robert F. Kennedy Jr. speak out against mandatory vaccinations in the same spot where his uncle, John F. Kennedy, spoke in Berlin nearly 60 years ago. It's a reality where the people who showed up are not right-wing neo-Nazis, as the New York Times reported, but ordinary citizens from across the political spectrum alarmed by what they see as totalitarianism. Our guide on this journey is journalist Mark Crispin Miller, who set out on a journey himself some 15 years ago to delve into the truth about America's electile dysfunction, stolen elections, and found himself at odds with his own progressive tribe. The further he has gone into exploring what others have termed conspiracy theories, the more he has discovered conspiracy facts, discomforting truths that indicate that those with too much money and too much power, con man pirates, have already decided what our future will be like, and this future may not be to our liking. As the Bible didn't quite say, the truth shall upset you free. And in these apocalyptic and in many ways apoplectic times, when the veils are being lifted on all sorts of things we would prefer not to look at, Mark Crispin Miller has had the courage to speak up where others have been silent. Now, I may not agree with everything he says, and you might not either. However, beyond the polarizing and incomplete narratives on both sides, Mark is going to give you a chance to look at a bigger picture. Mark Crispin Miller earned his bachelor's degree from Northwestern University in 1971 and his doctorate in English from Johns Hopkins in 1977. He is currently a professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University. He is the author of several books, including The Bush Dyslexicon, Observations on a National Disorder, Cruel and Unusual, Bush Cheney's New World Order, and what we'll be talking a little bit about shortly, Fooled Again, The Real Case for Electoral Reform. He's the editor of Forbidden Bookshelves, an ebook series that revives important works now out of print, most of which were variously killed at birth. He also wrote the introduction to the 2004 edition of Edward Bernays' classic book, Propaganda, and he is editor of News from the Underground. Welcome, Mark.
Well, thank you for that wonderful introduction, Steve, and it's a pleasure to be back with you again.
I'm glad you're here. I'm looking forward to hearing how you've unmasked the face mask issue, but first, for our listeners who aren't familiar with your work and your journey, tell us about how you first found yourself deviating from the accepted narratives after writing your Fooled Again book about the stolen elections in 2000 and 2004.
Well, it was focused mainly on 2004. It came out in 2005, and it came out from a very reputable publisher, Basic Books, whose personnel, like myself, were extremely optimistic about the impact this book would have because it demonstrates, I think, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that that was a stolen election. To their astonishment and mine, and the astonishment of a seasoned PR professional whom I hired myself, the book was blacked out. It got a total of 2 newspaper reviews in the entire country, one of them a hatchet job. I had often been on NPR speaking on various topics, and they would not have me on. The only network that would have me on was Fox. You know, Bill O'Reilly had me on so he could insult me, but at least he had me on. most remarkable thing about the reception of that book, if I can call it a reception, is that while the corporate media blacked it out completely, the left press, and these are people, many of whom are my friends, attacked it as conspiracy theory and called me a conspiracy theorist, which I found astonishing. But it was useful because it prompted me to look into the history of that epithet. Where did that come from? How is it that people came to be dismissed in that way, and that inconvenient ideas or information could be pigeonholed as sort of crackpot speculation? And what I discovered was that the epithet conspiracy theorist was almost never used by the American press. Conspiracy theory had been used from time to time, but only from time to time and in no consistent way. But starting in 1967, and I picked this up from consulting the archives of the New York Times and the Washington Post and Time magazine, starting in 1967, the phrase starts popping up more and more, and it was used, we find, by the CIA, who weaponized it in a memo. It's memo 1035-960. It's online. You can look it up. It was declassified years later. A memo sent out to all station chiefs worldwide instructing them to use their propaganda assets and friends in the media to attack the ideas of conspiracy theorists like Mark Lane, Sylvia Mayer. In other words, it was all about the rising understanding that the Warren Report about the Kennedy assassination was a feeble piece of work and raised many more questions than it answered. The CIA was alarmed by this development, and their counterattack entailed using conspiracy theory and conspiracy theorists to defame the authors of those books. And the memo also included a number of what we might call talking points, one of which we keep hearing to this day, which is, well, if it was a conspiracy, somebody would have talked by now. You know, we hear that about 9/11, we hear that about stolen elections. Well, you know, the Manhattan Project, I think, employed about 100,000 people, and nobody talked, and it took years to complete. So it's not even true, but it is very effective propaganda. So to make a long story short, that meme continued to be used more and more, and always in the same way, always to refute or debunk notions of some kind of state crime against democracy. So assassinations, stolen elections, false flag attacks. Through the years, these memes were used more and more to the point that now we have all long since internalized this. And I'm sure many of your listeners will know the feeling or will remember having said, well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but, right? And then you express some perfectly reasonable suspicions, you know, that anybody would have and would readily have if we were talking about, say, Russia, you know, some other country. You would immediately suspect official claims that are patently absurd, right? So it is, in my view, one of the most successful propaganda drives, certainly in modern history, because what it has done, and let me add, I urged my friend Lance DeHaven Smith, who's a professor at Florida Atlantic University, who had come to the same discovery as I had. I urged him to write a book about it for a series I was editing at the University of Texas Press, and he did write a book, which I strongly recommend. It's called Conspiracy Theory in America. Brilliant book, and in it he demonstrates that this propaganda drive has actually succeeded in changing the way Americans think about elites, the way they think about power. But there was a long history in this country of immediate distrust at elite intentions. I mean, it goes back to the Declaration of Independence. And it drove throughout the 19th century and into the 20th century. It was okay to suspect elites of being up to no good. But since that meme has conquered so many hearts and minds, you now feel apologetic, and you actually risk being ostracized. You even risk, you know, losing your job if you're in the media or academia, if you dare suggest that something isn't what it's been advertised to be, you know. And the bigger and more traumatic the event is, the more furious people become if you dare question it. But I think we're obliged to keep our heads. Any propaganda drive that's based on fear is going to succeed if people don't make the effort to try to think straight, try to think outside the narrative, ask certain basic questions about it, see what's going on in other parts of the world. In other words, make these efforts to look at the propaganda instead of through it, and see if it's true or not.
You know, this is really very interesting because I love that phrase. It's a very cogent phrase, state crime against democracy.
Right.
I think that's really a very succinct way of putting these perpetrations that you've uncovered. And yet so many other people that you've considered your colleagues, surely they're as intelligent as you are. What is it that has prevented more people from crossing the line that you've been able to cross?
Well, that's a very good question. There are a few ways to answer it, or I should say there are a few answers to it. One is that if you question some fundamental narrative, some narrative that you've long since absorbed and believe, that's potentially very threatening, because what that means is that, first of all, you have been fooled, you know, which a lot of good progressives, especially in the academy, never want to admit. I mean, we all like to think we're well-informed. So it's a bridge too far. You don't dare do it, and you just react sort of angrily and dismiss it. So that's one reason for it. That's kind of a psychological explanation. I'm afraid, however, that when it comes to the media, and even some of my friends or former friends on the left in the media, I think that it's a matter of their funding, and I also think that in some cases it's a matter of intelligence connections. I mean, the CIA has been doing this kind of thing all over the world for decades. If you read Philip Agee's CIA diary, just to name one of many books written by disillusioned veterans of the agency over the years. There's about five or six really good ones. You see that this kind of thing is not that far-fetched at all. In fact, it makes sense. If I were in the CIA, I would do that. I would cultivate enlightened liberal opinion. And the CIA has been doing that forever. Well, why not here? Why on earth would they not do it here? Why would Big Pharma, to pick another powerful entity, why would they not cultivate, liberal journalists? You know, Bill Gates, there's an excellent piece that I strongly recommend in the latest Columbia Journalism Review about how much Bill Gates has spent on the media to date. Since he founded his foundation, he has spent $250 million, which has gone to the New York Times, it's gone to the Atlantic, it's gone to NPR, it's gone to NBC News. He has a whole army of so-called fact checkers actually working for him. So if you do a Google search on something involving him, you will inevitably find first, page after page after page of sites you're asking about. I mean, even if you're just looking for the facts, you know. So you say, you know, Bill Gates, polio vaccine, India. You just want to know what the basic facts are. You almost can't find them on Google. This is a serious problem, you know, and it relates to the way the New York Times utterly distorted what happened in Germany when Bobby spoke there. We're really, speaking of Germany, you know, we really are now living at a moment that is strongly reminiscent of Germany in the late 30s. There's a,
well, I'm going to hold you up right there. We're going to take a short break, Mark, and we'll be back talking more about the Bobby Kennedy Jr. and
okay.
Germany and COVID. This is Steve Behrman. We're talking with journalist Mark Crispin Miller on WikiPolitik. Well, speaking of the devil, it's everywhere. It's ubiquitous. This propaganda campaign is everywhere. Let's talk about what put you on my radar yesterday, which is your the long article that you're writing about face masks, which I'm calling it Masking Unmasked, because this is upside down times. I mean, think about it. These days, the ones without the masks are the outlaws, right?
So, right.
it's all upside down. So, tell me a little bit about how you came to be interested in the mask issue, and how you developed your point of view on that, and what do you know about it?
Yeah, well, let me preface this by saying that I lost a friend to COVID-19. I almost lost another. And I was myself, for a while, quite terrified of the virus. I'm 70. I have Lyme disease. So I was masked. You know, I was always wearing them in the elevator and so on. But you know, as I was saying before, once you start to take a kind of calm look around and get a hold of yourself and start to look into scientific evidence, for example, and a lot of other data, you begin. Well, I came to realize that the whole masking thing is not just unwise. That is, masks are not just ineffective, and I can, you know, kind of verify that in a moment. But they're actually hazardous. They do more harm than good. They do more physical harm than good, and they're certainly doing more social and psychological harm than good. There's something deeply perverse about it. I mean, what I'm offering here really is good news, but I know that some of your listeners will simply bridle at what I'm saying, or, you know, maybe have already switched the radio off. I don't know. I know from conversations with my own colleagues at NYU, you know, and others, that even to suggest such a thing is heresy. It is so infuriating that they can't have the conversation. Anyway, I've been tangentially involved in a really indispensable series of documentary interviews called Perspectives on the Pandemic, which you can find. Some of them have been taken down by YouTube, but they're all up on BitChute. And there have been about 10 of them, really excellent interviews with leading epidemiologists and others. And through that work and my own study and my awareness of how propaganda works, I came to see that this is baseless. You know, this is baseless and highly divisive at a time when I believe the powers that be are doing everything they can to divide the American people. I mean, they've been doing that since the 60s, and they've certainly done it now with a kind of exquisite sophistication by promoting this mask narrative and the idea that if you don't wear them or don't believe in wearing them, you're somehow on the alt-right, you're a Trump supporter. That's just an automatic assumption. Well, you know, I don't really care what Trump says or does. You know, I have no respect for him. I would never support him. What he says or does is completely irrelevant to the abundant scientific evidence that masks don't work. And I'll simply say that there are all the randomized controlled tests of face masks and respirators, there are 8 of them, they all demonstrate that these things do not prevent the transmission of respiratory viruses. They simply don't. The virions, you know, which infect us, are much too small for these porous masks to prevent their transmission. And respirators can't really work because it's almost impossible to get them to fit your face very tightly. Now, let me add that we need to know what it is that frontline healthcare workers use to protect themselves from the coronavirus, okay? They wear a mask and a face shield and goggles, right? As well as booties, gloves, and a gown, okay? That's quite a getup. I mean, I know nurses who, I know one in particular who worked at Elmhurst Hospital, you know, the notorious epicenter of the epicenter. She served there for a month as a volunteer from Florida. And, you know, she knows all about this. She explained to me what precautions they took. Let me add also that she discovered that people were essentially being murdered there. That's one of the interviews in the pandemic's series that I mentioned, a must-see. At any rate, the idea that non-healthcare professionals, just average healthy people, could protect themselves against such a virus just by wearing a mask, just by wearing a cloth mask. Cloth masks are the most hazardous. There was a study in the British Medical Journal in 2015, which warned against the use of cloth face masks by healthcare professionals because they tend to be infectious. They trap bacteria. They retain moisture. Okay. Now, this is a body of studies concerning healthcare professionals who at least know how to wear masks properly, right? Now we have a moment where healthy people all over the world are being required to wear masks, which not only will fail to protect them, but which actually compromise your health. It actually weakens your immune system. It induces conditions such as hypoxia, which is like deoxygenation, which makes you irritable and dumber. You know, it having students wear masks in elementary and high schools is just perverse. You know, at any rate, it is a terrible idea. It's been demonstrated not to work. Finland, Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Belarus, and Iceland, as well as Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, and the Dakotas, never had mask mandates, okay? And those countries got through the crisis fine. Some of them did vastly better than Spain and Belgium and the UK, where masking was required. Let me say one last thing about this. New Zealand, you know, whose draconian policies the WHO has praised as exemplary for all nations, they never had a mask mandate because their health authorities studied the literature that I'm referring to now and realized these masks aren't going to make any difference. They did not require New Zealanders to wear them. Recently, the Netherlands, the Dutch government, came to the same conclusion, you know, with this sort of uptick in cases of COVID in Europe. The government of the Netherlands announced, you know, we've studied the scientific literature. There is no point in wearing masks. You know, it's just not a good idea. So they don't. So I feel very strongly about this because I see all around me in the summer heat, little children playing in masks. I mean, this is like child abuse. I see old people, you know, some of my friends, old people, some have asthma, some have COPD, and they're wearing masks. Now, if you go to the website of OSHA, you know, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, they have very stringent stipulations as to who should be required to wear a mask in a workplace and who should not. They're very, very clear. And they are very clear that for people suffering quite a number of medical conditions, you know, I mentioned asthma, COPD, diabetes, cardiovascular conditions, any kind of heart disease, you are not to be required to wear a mask, okay? So, you know, people out there in the streets who aren't wearing them, I mean, they could conceivably be Trump supporters. I have no idea. They may just be libertarians, or they might just be asthmatic, you know? They might have a good reason not to wear a mask. So, you know, as I say, we need to be rational about this. Let me add one last piece of information. Hong Kong was held up by health authorities as the best possible example of an effective masking policy. You know, into June, they were hailing the people of Hong Kong who had a compliance rate of 99.98%. Almost everybody there was wearing a mask. Well, guess what? In July, there was what the South China Morning Post called a third wave of COVID, which meant 38 people tested positive. And, you know, obviously the masks did not prevent that. The people of Wuhan, where the thing first broke out, you know, Wuhan has had an air pollution problem so severe that in late 2019, there were actually mass protests over it. It's toxic smog. Everybody in Wuhan was masked to protect themselves against that. Well, what good did that do? I mean, that's where the virus allegedly first appeared, although there's evidence it appeared elsewhere prior to that. But what I'm saying is, if we simply try to be reasonable, which isn't always easy, you know, when you're gripped by fear, try to be reasonable, try to be open-minded, try to look at the scientific evidence, and we'll see that to put it mildly, an ill-advised policy that's driving people apart, that's actually making people sick. I have a long section in this big essay I've written on masking, which is just a series of accounts by and about people who have been severely injured by masking. I mean, here's something that was never reported in the U.S. Three Chinese teenagers dropped dead running laps in their gym classes in three different provinces of China. This happened in the spring. It moved the health authorities there to put a ban on exercising while wearing a mask. And I had a Chinese student of mine. That was in an article published in an English language outlet. I asked a Chinese student of mine to review the press over there, and she found another three different articles about three adults who were exercising in masks. Two of them dropped dead, and one of them slipped into a coma. Now, this got a lot of coverage in Japan, right? It got covered by one TV station in Sydney, Australia, and it was mentioned. The three students were mentioned in the New York Daily News and the New York Post. They misreported it as two students, but that's the extent of the coverage. Okay, that's really alarming. You know, you'd think that a mandate that has been so vigorously pushed and tightened and extended, even as the rates of the coronavirus have dropped, even as the mortality rates have approached zero, okay, the mandates have become stricter. You would think that in a country with a free press, that press, acting in the best interests of the people, would at least report these things. But I have found a total of one article about a kind of mask casualty. It was in People magazine. It was about a guy in New Jersey who was driving in a mask. He passed out and drove into a tree. Okay? That did happen. The article was featured as a human interest story, you know? Like it was some oddity. It was not an oddity. Listen, I have a very close friend who was an extremely eminent researcher into the JFK assassination, and he was completely paranoid about this disease. He went everywhere in a mask, and he was out vigorously walking his dog just last week, a very hot day, and he died. He dropped dead. Now, this doesn't get any coverage. Nobody reports this. But then nobody reports the fact that, as Johns Hopkins researchers have determined, 10,000 children a month are dying of hunger around the world because of the lockdowns. Nobody's reporting the skyrocketing rates of suicide. Nobody's reporting the drug overdoses that have skyrocketed, or the deaths by domestic violence, you know? I mean, in other words, the lockdowns have had a far more disastrous effect on people's health worldwide than the coronavirus ever did. But because the media has over-focused on that only, has terrorized people into thinking as if that's the only cause of death. It's really like that. Nobody died before this thing came along. All those other casualties, all those poor people, you know, all those guys out, you know, riding their bikes in the cities to make deliveries to people who are more privileged, all of them wearing masks as they, you know, pump their legs in the heat. This is beyond irrational. This is really criminal. That's what has moved me to write all this up, because the story has been so grotesquely misreported. There's a section in the essay early on where I simply offer a panoramic view of the brutality inflicted on unmasked people all over the world by the police, and not just in third world countries, not just in China, but all over the U.S. as well. And many, many cases of insane violence and brutality by masked people on unmasked people. Now, there are indeed incidents. There have been incidents of unmasked people, you know, flipping out on you know, workers at Walmart asking them to put on masks. Those instances are heavily reported, okay? The press has heavily focused on those cases. The New York Times has looked at that, and looked at that only. But that is a very, very one-sided, I think deliberately one-sided, kind of coverage that is serving the purposes of the overall propaganda drive, which is telling us, if you don't put on a mask, you are a rotten human being. You are a selfish pig. You're putting everybody at risk. I mean, I've heard this myself. It's really something to see how livid people become, and irrational and profane, you know, how bellicose they are about this. This tells us that it's not a rational position, and it also tells us that it's not really an altruistic position, because if you were really arguing in an altruistic spirit, you wouldn't simply go on the attack. You know, use the F word 1,000 times. I mean, it's really pretty staggering. So this is a lot like the propaganda drive against Germany in World War I. It's a lot like the Red Scare. It's a lot like the War on Terror. It is exactly that kind of war propaganda where you are convincing people that they're in danger and that anyone who says otherwise is a threat to you, is an enemy, is a Hun lover, loves terrorists, you know, must be a Red. It's exactly, you must be an anti-vaxxer. You must be a pro-Trumper. You know, this kind of turbocharged hate speech, which is what it is not getting us anywhere. And it's, again, it's deepening the divides, you know, between different sides and fracturing we the people. You know, what we most need in this country now, and what we've needed for decades, is unity. You know, we need to make common cause with people we don't agree with. We need to focus our animosity and our attention on the elites who are driving all this, you know, who are making billions and billions of dollars, especially since this crisis began, shattering small businesses all over the country, that are being scooped up for pennies on the dollar by the likes of Jeff Bezos. I mean, this all benefits those guys. It benefits Gates. It benefits Microsoft. It benefits Google. You know, it benefits Elon Musk. That's what this is really all about. We have to be you know, mindful of who the real enemy is here, and we shouldn't be at one another's throats, it seems to me.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back with Mark Crispin Miller talking more about an even bigger picture. We'll be back very shortly. Steve Behrman. Well, hi, this is Steve Behrman. We're back with Mark Crispin Miller. So much to talk about, so little time. A little irony supplement. Your associate, who unfortunately passed away while walking his dog, he was a hero of another friend of mine, who is a rabid advocate of wearing masks in the official story. I don't think he knows that this fellow was wearing a mask at the time. I know who you're talking about. And,
yeah, I know. I hesitate to name him.
I wouldn't, but I know the guy. I also admired his work very much, and my friend, who is, one of these people who has been on the Kennedy assassination case forever, but he can't seem to get on board with any alternative view of this COVID situation. And I think it is because there are people getting sick from it, and there doesn't seem to be a coherent policy anywhere to deal with it. Have you found some kind of coherent approach that paces the science that you understand that could possibly be an effective way of dealing with this? Could there be
herd
immunity?
Well, we are approaching herd immunity. You know, people flip out when the New York Times talks about an alarming surge in cases. They use the word cases. Cases. All that means is that a certain number of people have tested positive. There's a difference between the case level, the number of cases, and the crucial statistic, which is the infection mortality rate. That's the number of people who got sick with COVID and died of it. Okay? That number, the more cases they report, the smaller the percentage is of those who've actually died of the disease. So the fact is that as in any epidemic or pandemic, you know, the more people get it, the better it is, you know, because the virus weakens as it spreads, and the vast majority of cases are asymptomatic, okay? This is very important for people to understand. It is not bad news. It is not cause for further lockdowns and restrictions when the number of cases goes up. Okay? Now let's talk about people who catch it, who are at risk. Here's another place where the propaganda has, to put it mildly, served us poorly. There is an effective remedy for this. There's actually a few. But doctors all over the world, all over the country, hospitals in Houston and in Tampa and in Michigan have been successfully using a combination of hydroxychloroquine, zinc, and azithromycin, the antibiotic, okay? HCQ, as we call it, has been around for 60 years to treat malaria and other things like that. And the fact that it's not only been described and misdescribed as ineffective, but as dangerous. And the fact, even worse, that governors like Governor Cuomo here in New York have actually put limits on a doctor's ability to prescribe it. I mean, this is unforgivable, you know. This is an effective, and I don't really care that Donald Trump touted the drug. He did, okay? Again, what he says should not determine what we think, okay? Certainly his fans believe every word he said, but it's no better to believe the opposite of everything he says, as so many progressives do. If he said it, it must be false. What he says is irrelevant. I personally know two people who recovered from serious cases of COVID thanks to this regimen, okay? And I can, you know, there are studies from all over the world attesting to the effectiveness of this treatment, but to see it's a generic drug. It's not going to make anybody any dough. And more importantly, and this is something we haven't even touched on yet, and what this is all about, is the mandatory vaccination with one of these, you know, god-awful COVID experimental vaccines, you know, which once you start researching what's in those things, I mean, you're going to lose sleep over it. Anyone who gets that shot is either completely uninformed or needs to have his head examined. The fact is that HCQ's effectiveness has been blacked out because it stands in the way of this campaign to get everybody desperate for that shot, okay? That shot is something to be avoided at all costs. It is not necessary because hydroxychloroquine is an effective remedy. Ivermectin is another drug that's shown tremendous promise. And there are other treatments that are, you know, affordable and successful. I mean, in my essay, not the part you've read, but I have a whole long paragraph listing remedies that have been used all over the world, some developed in Cuba, some in Israel, you know, some in Japan, that are working. They work. If people can get their hands on them and they have COVID-19, they will get well, you know, unless they have serious comorbidities and are very, very old. By the way, here's something that the CDC itself revealed last week. It has been reported nowhere, although it's flying all over social media. I couldn't even believe my own eyes when I read it. The CDC came out with an update a few days ago on COVID-19 mortality rates. And in this update, they say that 6% of the total of something like 154,000 COVID deaths, 6% were due to COVID alone, okay? The 94% of those deaths were people with 2.6 serious comorbidities, like heart disease or diabetes or obesity, and the vast majority were around 90 years old and in nursing homes. Nursing homes, those are the people who should have been quarantined first, most protectively, most carefully, all along, from the beginning. They should have been protected. They should not have forced healthy people to stay home and social distance and wear masks. In no previous pandemic has that ever happened. It didn't even happen during the so-called Spanish flu in 1918, which was vastly more lethal than COVID-19. Never before have whole populations been ordered to shelter in place to deal with a pandemic. The people who needed to be protected were actually put at greater risk in New York, in Michigan, in Washington, in California, and in North Carolina by governors who ordered nursing homes to take in COVID patients, okay? That's criminal, okay? It's either criminal negligence or something worse, but it certainly killed a lot of old people, and that's the vast majority of those killed by COVID-19, okay? So guess what happened? Trump tweeted that update, okay? He tweeted it. Twitter deleted the tweet. Okay? So here we have another example. All good liberals and progressives will say, well, it's obviously not true because Trump tweeted it. But it is true. I mean, we if you're going to be strict about it in doing the math, what 6% amounts to is a little over 9,000 deaths. All right? Maybe a considerable number more than that. For them, COVID was like the straw that broke the camel's back. They had other diseases. They caught COVID, too, and that finished them off. So maybe it's 40,000 or 50,000. Whatever the number of that is, the point of the update, right, the point of the update is that the lockdowns were unnecessary, right? There was no reason for them. The vulnerable should have been protected first, right, as in any pandemic. And they were not. They were not. And let me add one. Go ahead.
Go ahead, yeah. No, you add one thing. I got one final question for you.
Yeah, okay. Denis Rancourt, who's a physicist in Canada and has been all over this, a very skilled and meticulous scientist, he did an analysis of the excess deaths. There was a so-called COVID peak in April. If you look at the graphs, it's bizarre. There's a sudden peak of deaths over a very short period, and then it just as rapidly declined. Nobody's ever seen anything like this in the history of pandemics or epidemics. He did a close study, and he determined that what caused that sudden uptick of deaths was the lockdowns, which isolated, cut off countless sick old people, you know, in hospitals and nursing homes who now were not allowed to see friends or family. Nobody could visit them. They were all alone, okay? The despair, the loneliness seems to have caused a lot of people to just give up the ghost, okay? That's really significant, and that's the kind of thing we should be thinking about and focusing on, is the science of it all.
Let's get to one final thing in the next 4 or 5 minutes that we have left, because I think that you've made a pretty clear case that what we've been doing is, to say the least, counterindicated.
Right.
But let's look at the agenda, the vaccination agenda. You know, again, once again, here we are in quote-unquote conspiracy theory territory, you know, where there's a vast conspiracy of elites. We don't even have to go to the QAnon narrative about pedophilia and so on. But what do you think, I mean, seriously, what do you think there is a nefarious agenda in terms of Bill Gates, vaccinations, controlling the world, surveillance? This is stuff that RFK Jr., by the way, in his talk in Berlin the other day, he went there. He went that particular, yeah, talking about basically totalitarianism, mass surveillance, et cetera, et cetera. Do you see, I know you can't really outlay it in a very short amount of time, but do you see that that is a reasonable idea, or is it simply a paranoid idea?
No, to call that paranoid is simply to be blind to the obvious. You know, you now have a population that's under increasingly tight scrutiny, and the prospect of a cashless society. This is being floated on the pretext that cash is dirty and swarming with viruses, right? With the disappearance of cash, so that all transactions are online, the economy is totally controlled, and so are the rest of us. Because as in China, so here, it will be a very simple matter simply to shut off the revenue supply of anyone who is making trouble, anyone who's dissident. You know, as you say, this should be the topic for a whole further discussion. But I will simply say this, and it's the darkest thing I've said, but I'm afraid there's a great deal of historical justification for it. What I think we're facing, aside from a kind of dystopian, you know, world order, which has been laid out in black and white in many documents from the UN and the Rockefeller Foundation, it's not a fantasy. This is also going to entail a kind of eugenic exercise of getting rid of as many people as possible. Bill Gates himself has said in unguarded moments that he'd like to see a world population of 2 billion. You know, in his TED talk in 2010, he talked about reducing world population by 15%. But people like him, like Ted Turner, who is a rabid eugenicist, they are all operating in the tradition of the Rockefellers, who were very, very big supporters of the eugenics movement in the United States and of the eugenics movement in Germany. So is the Carnegie Foundation. We're talking about, you know, people who believe that the unfit, should basically be killed. They are useless eaters. And at a time when the working class is no longer a kind of a feature of capitalist or post-capitalist economy, they're not needed, you know. The worker bees are all in places like Vietnam and China and Mexico. There is no reason to doubt that a lot of these seemingly blundering policies that have killed so many people, there's no reason to doubt that it might not be deliberate. And I know a lot of people aren't going to want to go there. But if you just read Edwin Black's magisterial history of the eugenics movement, it's called War Against the Weak, you realize the eugenics movement didn't really go away after the revelation of the Holocaust, which was a little bit embarrassing to them because they were all praising Hitler's race hygiene policies. And then there was the death camps, and it looked so bad. So they went underground, and they reemerged as a population control movement. The Rockefellers founded the Population Council in 1952. Well, you know, the past is prologue, it seems to me, that we absolutely must cease to believe that these very powerful interests are really concerned about our well-being. They're not, okay? I don't think Trump is either. I mean, you know, just to get away from the kind of partisan blue-red bullshit for a minute.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah, I think we've got to face reality here, that it isn't just by accident that all these horrible things have happened and are happening to so many of us all around the world.
Wow. Well, thank you, Mark Chris Miller, for being my guest today on Wiki Politiki and laying that out and giving people plenty of food for thought. As the Bible didn't say, the truth shall set you free. Mark Chris Miller, live his notes from the underground. We'll be back next week. Thank you, Mark.